Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As Mother's Day approaches, a writer reflects on his mother's cooking. And I suppose for most sons, their mother is the best cook in the world, and it's no different for Pulitzer Prize winning writer Rick Bragg, whose mother seemed to live in the kitchen, an area that was off limits to him well into his adulthood. It was only when the stove grew cold when his mother was hospitalized by a lengthy illness that he wanted her to share the recipes of their family, only to learn there were no recipes or rules. So he talked with her as she cooked, rib-sticking Southern food like pinto beans and ham, fried chicken, red-eye gravy, buttermilk and cornbread patties, collard greens and baked hog jowls, and even more exotic food for when times were tough and money thin. But Bragg's book, The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mother's Table, isn't a cookbook. I'd even say the recipes in it are far from traditional recipes. The book's more of a cross between a family memoir and a book about food. Or as Dorothy Bragg says, all good food has a story. Rick Bragg won a Pulitzer Prize for his feature reporting and is the author of 8 books, including the bestsellers Ava's Ban and All Over But the Shoutin'. He'll be a guest of the Tulsa City County Library and Booksmart Tulsa next Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock at Central Library. His new book, The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table, is published by Alfred Knopf. Rick Bragg, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
No, thank you.
This book, I'm still trying to figure out if it is a family memoir with food and recipes or food and recipes with a family memoir, and I think it's really the former. This is an excuse to really tell these wonderful stories that you must have collected over a lot of years about your family. What was the impetus for writing this?
Well, that was kind of the problem, because we've always had the stories. You know, as you said, we've always kind of had the stories. There's an old term in the newspaper business called a dog's breakfast, you know, and it's whatever is left over. And that makes it sound like, you know, scraps, but that's not it. It's all those things that you didn't have a home for. You know, you didn't really have a good place for it, so you saved them and saved them and saved them and saved them. Because the tangents, you know, that you'd run off in the writing, you know, would take you too far. You know, and you might not ever get back to the point. Kind of like listening to my people tell a story. Right. You know, or for that matter, you asking me one. But I knew we had the stories. And I knew that how easy it is to tie the stories to the food. The problem was the science, the math, you know. Trying to get an old woman who kind of was taught by cooks almost as if it was alchemy, you know, or a history lesson, to try to write down an ingredient, that was tough.
Yeah, a dab, a smidgen, whatever, you know.
You know, hun, just use some. Well, what in the world is some?
And this is from a mother who would never let you in the kitchen.
No, so, I mean, she would, you know, give us a hug or, you know, let us maybe stay as we ran through. But, I mean, you got to understand, we were nasty. We were boy children, and we were always covered in effluvium of some kind, you know, tadpole scum, or literally carrying a frog or a turtle, and, you know, coal dust and red mud and all manner of toxins. And, you know, Mama's not a prim and proper woman, but she's a country cook, and country cooks don't want pollution in their kitchens.
Yeah,
we were pollution.
It was serious business in the kitchen.
It was. She wanted to concentrate. She wanted to take her time, and she didn't want to be messed with. And for that reason, the phone remains like her least favorite invention. She wrote a poem about it once and called it "That Damn Phone." So, yeah.
The very opening essay of this book, The Best Cook in the World, is a beautiful piece of writing, and it talks about the love your mother got out of a skillet, and it was the way she doled out love, it seems like. But it's some beautiful writing, and in it you describe a moment where your mother got sick, she was in the hospital, she was away from the little house with the, what is it, 22 or 23 used up stoves in the back of the in the backyard.
I think 13 might be closer to it. Yeah, yeah.
And how wrong the house felt when it was empty. Was that really an impetus to begin writing this particular book?
It was that combined with the knowledge, the kind of slow realization that we'd just taken it all for granted for so long. But yeah, Mama, we liked to lost my mom. And she was in her 80s, and she was she had a terrible bout with cancer, and there was a long, long recuperation, and even a longer period, it seemed, where, you know, every day was just fraught with misery because, you know, there's, I can't imagine a world without my mom in it, as most people cannot. And I was walking through that kitchen to get her some clothes to take to the hospital because she will not wear that hospital gown any more than she would wear a bikini. You know, she just will not wear a hospital gown, so I have to take her. She lies in her hospital bed, I'm not kidding, in, like, khaki pants and two pairs of socks and thermal underwear. And, you know, so you have to fetch your clothes. And when I walked through that kitchen and there was that smell of not, you know, cooking cornbread or, you know, bacon biscuits or that ever-present, that bacon grease smell, you know, that smell of bacon grease that she had saved or lard that she had saved, or there was none of that. It was just that cold iron smell. And old cooks know what I'm talking about, just old cold iron, you know, from those skillets, you know, empty. And I'll never forget this lemon-scented dishwashing detergent that up until then I'd always thought was a pleasant smell. But it just kind of scared me to death. And it wasn't so much to do these recipes. I thought that they needed to be done in an archival sense. So that certainly will be the case, you know. Someday, when we're all dust, you know, maybe that will be the case. But I wanted to do them while my mama was with us to talk about them, and while, you know, we could taste them, you know, really taste them. And we were lucky enough to get to do that.
You've been collecting your family stories for a long time. What was it that led you to start thinking of that as, this should be what I do, is tell these stories and write these stories down about your family? Was it outside advice, or was it something you started writing them down and people liked them?
I think that was probably that, you know, Rich. If, you know, a lot of people, you get a lot of guidance in this lifetime, thank goodness, because left to my own devices, I expect I would probably be sitting in the dirt just grinning, you know. I mean, I need some advice in this world. But I remember that old cliche, you know, from the writing business, write what you know. And I've been some places and seen some things and around the world, and but I can't say that I knew them. But I know my people. I know their sayings, and I know their foibles, and I know their rap sheets sometimes, and I know the fact that my Uncle Jimbo, who we buried just the other month, when he was 92, he was still cruising the cemetery, you know, on a regular basis, just cruising up down the little roads of the cemetery. And I asked him, I said, Uncle Jim, why you spend so much time in the cemetery? And he told me, he said, that's where the widow women are, son. And I hope he was kidding about that, but I think probably not. You know, but he also said something that I think he thought was funny that I took deadly serious, which is, to get somebody to appreciate a man your age, you got to go to a cemetery to find the people, you know, that live the creek banks and the river banks and the, you know, the hunts in the woods and you know, the all the family reunions. And I guess maybe there is an archival sense to it, I guess, but, you know, I was blessed with a family that was imperfect in a glorious way and was respectable in the sense that, you know, they were considered good people, but not respectable in a stodgy way. And, yeah. You know, there is, in this cookbook, you know, there's considerable theft in this cookbook. You know, there's hog theft and chicken theft, onion theft.
Cows led to the slaughter?
Yeah, exactly. Clandestine in the middle of the night hog slaughter. You know, it has some grit in it. And a lot of the recipes during the Depression were of just bald necessity. You know, they really did eat, like, you know, sweet potato pie and sweet potato cobbler for, like, probably 3 weeks because what they had was sweet potatoes. And my grandpa, Charlie Bundram, was in prison. He got caught. caught for transporting liquor. And while he was gone, they had a hard time. And, you know, when my grandma would announce, "Today we'll have pie," you know, the children rejoiced until they had it about 3 weeks in a row.
You sort of alluded to the idea of how difficult it was to get the recipes out of your mother. But
right.
What I really find interesting is this book is a series of stories that surround a food and inevitably a recipe at the end. But these recipes are not recipes in the normal sense. They're more like a stream of consciousness laying out of, it's like going through real time and making the recipe in many, many senses, the way the recipes are laid out.
Could you write that down for me? Because that's what I've been trying to tell people for 3 weeks, and I can't. I guess I tried to say it this way, that we kept writing in the recipes. You know, we kept Mama talking,
yeah.
You know, in the recipes. We kept other people talking in the recipes. There's no reason for the recipe to be, you know, of course, there is a list of ingredients, as you know, but I hope that people try to cook these things. I hope they cook them and they enjoy them, because I think they will. You know, if you like salt and fat and grease, you'll like some of these recipes. But also, if you like fresh vegetables, you know, if you like garden vegetables, you know, if you like a fresh tomato, you'll like these recipes. But I didn't know how to do a test kitchen recipe. And it's a little late in my life to teach me to do anything. So I just tried to write them the way that she told them to me. And, you know, my mama can be a talker once she gets going.
Well, I found something that was interesting. I think you wrote it at one point in the book. It says, you know, your family is pretty laconic, except when it comes to food. And people who will never, in other senses, maybe give you a yep and out, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
When they're talking about food, all of a sudden they become loquacious.
Absolutely. You know, some people are food, cars is the other thing. If they're talking about cars or trucks or dogs, you know, or snakes, you know, they'll really be philosophical about it. If they're talking religion, you know, they can get very philosophical and can really spin some tales. And, you know, hunting, fishing, they can really do it. But food seems to bring out the very richest of the language in them. And I think it's just natural, you know, that it be that way. I mean, if you're describing a barbecued bologna sandwich, how in the world is that going to be dull? You know, if you're describing good fried chicken, how can that be dull? One of my favorite dishes is slow-cooked short ribs with potatoes and onions. You know, describing that meal with a side of fresh green beans and a side of red cabbage and carrot slaw with just a little bit of mayonnaise and black pepper, you know, and a good cornbread muffin. You know, I just think describing the food lends itself to a certain amount of kind of fun and storytelling and I hope good writing, although that might be a bit presumptuous, but I hope that's what happens. And I won't say it was easy to do, but it was fun.
My guest today is Rick Bragg, the Pulitzer Prize winning author. His latest book is titled The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table. And it is a really wonderful family memoir, cooking book. But I wouldn't say it's a cookbook. It's a cooking book. And it's about the role of food in his over generations in his family. Because the book, actually, first story in the book is 1924, the story of your great-grandmother, Ava, who was taught to cook by her, what was apparently her no-count father-in-law.
I think that's how we say it. Generous way to put
it.
I
don't know if we say that in Alabama. We'd probably say that in Oklahoma.
Right.
Who was sort of on the run and hiding out, and he comes to live with your great-grandmother and grandfather because your great-grandfather is starving because his new wife can't cook. These were just wonderful, wonderful stories of him teaching her how to cook, and I guess they've stayed in your family the whole time?
Absolutely. I used to sleep at the, you know, it's like I said, the stories just kind of well up here. You know, if you wait long enough in the same spot, it will well up, and which is one of the terrifying things about seeing this generation pass of, you know, of my kin. But, you know, my grandma was, bless her heart, you know, she married my grandfather under false pretenses. Her her sisters wanted to get her out of the house. You know, she was peculiar and she was short-tempered, so they made a box lunch. They cooked a great supper and put it in a box and sent her off to a dance where, you know, people bid on the, you know, on the food. And
just so like out of Oklahoma.
Yeah, exactly. My grandpa, Charlie, bought a blind mare. That's a terrible choice of words, but, you know, he bought the supper, loved it, and fell in love with my grandma and married for love and proceeded to starve to death because she had no interest in food. You know, she was just one of those people who did not see any real point in food other than staying alive. And the only person he could think of after she ran off all my great aunts and her aunts, because, again, she was so short-tempered that the only person he could think of who might stand up to her was this old felon, you know, this old man in hiding. So he went and got him and, you know, rode into the mountains, found his daddy, and said, as he rode up, "Daddy, I have married a pretty woman who cannot cook, and I am starving to death." And it remains my favorite quote in the whole book. And, you know, to hear that, listen to those stories over the years, and finally get the home for them, you know, it's about as much fun as I've had.
Now, you mentioned the beef short ribs. The story that goes with that is a great story. It's a cattleman comes up and says, "I have a cow going missing." I understand he's talking about your great-grandfather.
Right.
He says, I hear you can track. And he goes, "Yep." And he eventually tracks the cow down. The cow's recently been killed, apparently by a train that went over. For some strange reason, the cow was walking on a trestle.
Yeah, imagine a cow wanting to, of its own volition, cross a railroad trestle. But the story was always that, you know, I don't know what the statute of limitations is on stealing a cow. Probably it's passed. But, yeah, the story is that my grandpa might have helped it up on that trestle. And then he got paid for going to get it. And he didn't get in any kind of trouble for doing it because he didn't steal the whole cow. He really just stole the part that the cattleman gave him. So it was, I don't know, a third of a sin, a fourth of a sin, a quarter leg section of a sin. That's better than a whole sin.
Now, one of the things I love about this book is you tell some of the folklore that's a big part of growing up back in the hollers and the like. And you tell a story, I think this is about when your mother was born, about the woman, a cousin, who came to care for the family right after her mother had given birth. And she walked, I believe this is your mother, correct? She walked
right.
The mother around the house. So what is the whole story of walking the person around the house?
This is one of those traditions, and I find kind of the warmest of all the old things that people just did. When a baby was born, it was kind of a gift, not to the child, but to the kin, who someone would hand them the baby, the newborn, and they would carry it around the house, talking to it, or maybe not talking, maybe just, I don't know, breathing with it. And the story, the belief, let's call it a belief because that's what it was that the child would somehow inherit some of the character of the person who carried it around the house. So you were careful who you handed the baby to. And my grandpa had carried my mom around the house, but see, that doesn't count. The parent can't do it. And they handed the child to the great, boy, talk about cooks, best cooks in the world, the great Sis Morrison, who was a large, loud, tough...
Profane.
Yeah, profane did enter into it. She could outcuss most people I've ever even, like, imagined. And but she was a gentle soul with a genuine love for people and for cooking for them. And she carried my mom around the house. And that... And why not believe in things like that? Why not? Is that any harder to believe than anything else? And my mama would inherit, you know, that love of cooking for people. And look, I choose to believe it, and I wrote the book. So there. And my mama would grow up to be, you know, more of a strong-willed but outwardly gentle person. But Sis was just tough. I mean, she's the one who shot her husband in the teeth with a snub-nosed 22 pistol, and you cannot make that up. She shot him in his canines with a short-barreled 22 short, and he lived, you know. And her only comment after the fact was, and I guess in form of an apology, was, "Just be glad I only had that pop gun. If I had a 38, I'd have killed you, you little SB." And that's our people.
Well, I also love the story about Clem Ritter. You got to tell the story.
My Aunt Gracie Juanita is, without a doubt, one of the better storytellers in the foothills of the Appalachians. She, oh God, what a tale she could tell when she was younger. But she told me the story of a day when her mama was frying chicken. And Ava's fried chicken was a thing of beauty, dusted with just enough flour, you know, flour, salt, black pepper. That's all it was. And that with green beans with little new potatoes in them and biscuits and chicken gravy was, you know, at that time was the meal. And you dare not be late. And my grandfather, after taking the girls out loafing around, was running late. He was trying to get home so he would not have to endure my grandmother's wrath. He was driving too fast on a dirt road, and the way my Aunt Juanita told it, she said, we were going down the road and the dust was just blowing up all around us, and here she come, hon, all wild-eyed and crazy-acting, running out of those weeds at the side of the road, and Daddy couldn't get stopped. And he slammed on his brakes, but he couldn't get stopped, and then she smacked her fist into her palm and said, and Daddy hit her. And we all piled out of the truck, and we looked down, and Daddy had run over her. Run over who? And she said, he had run over Clem Ritter, Clementine Ritter. He'd run over her head with his truck tire. And most stories in my family are punctuated with the word, my God. And I said, my God. And she said, yeah, hon, it was awful. Her head was all womp-sided. And I, you know, I'm dying inside. You know, I'm thinking, my God, my grandpa committed vehicular homicide. And I said, you didn't do anything for her? You know, you didn't, like, help her? And my Aunt Juanita said, oh, no, hon. See, Daddy just picked her up and slung her back off in the weeds. Mama had supper done. We had to get home. And, you know, I'm pretty much out of wind, you know, at that point. And I said, you didn't do anything? And she said, no, hon, we didn't have to. See, about dark, we looked out in the yard, and here she come. You know, still, you know, staggering and weaving up in the yard. Her head was still all womp-sided. And it was probably, I don't know how many minutes before anybody bothered to tell me in the telling of that story that Clem Ritter was a dog. And it remains one of those moments where I saw, you know, what little bit of rotten life I had kind of flash before my eyes. But because of the tide of the chicken, see, I had a place for it. You know, I had a place for it. And I knew it was probably one of those that I knew I was going to tell. And it was that line, mama had supper done, that, you know, was the bridge. And then all you got to do is say, well, what'd she cook? And it's chicken. And then you get into the killing of the chicken, and then you talk about the, you know, the killing of the chicken and the, you know, and the preparation and how important it was. And so, yeah, you know, that like I said, that part was easy. It was the math that's hard.
I tell you, in a lot of these stories, you're describing a way of life that in many ways is somewhat like anthropology, because that way of life is disappearing.
Well, it fades and it fades and it fades. And I keep going back to the funeral of my Uncle Jim, my mama's oldest brother. He had been such a grand teller of stories that standing there at that grave and watching him disappear into the ground, but not disappear because the stories remain. But still, even knowing that we would be talking about him and thinking about him, as I saw him, you know, go into that ground in this beautiful little cemetery in a place called White's Gap, yeah, I remember thinking, like, you could almost hear the hands of some giant clock you know, move into place, or you could hear a bridge fall from here to there. And if it wasn't heartbreaking enough, because he, you know, in a family of talkers, he was the talker. Mm. You know, he was the best there ever was. And he could tell you a story that was absolutely true and you'd be riveted. And he could also lie like a, you know, like a probate judge candidate. I mean, you know, he could tell you a lie and leave you spellbound about giant snakes and giant catfish. And I think there's a lot of value in writing about people you care about. I think there's a lot of value in writing them, warts and all. But I hope there's, I don't know if I'd call it archaeological or not, because I still feel it like it's real. You know, I still, when my people tell a story, I can still see those people, you know, staring back at me. And I, you know, I kind of hope that's what happens with this book. I hope people in Oklahoma try to cook it. They probably already know 90% of these recipes.
Yeah, a lot of them are very familiar. You're right.
You know, and I hope people on the Upper East Side in Manhattan do it. And I hope people in San Francisco do it or London do it. But I also hope, mostly hope, that it's folks in a wood frame house, or maybe a 2-bedroom brick rancher, or a mobile home with a redwood deck on the front. I hope they try to cook some of this stuff because they remember that their grandma, their mama, cooked it just like that, but maybe not just like that. And I'm ready to have that argument with folks.
All right. Well, I have to ask you one last question, and that is,
sure,
you sort of denigrate your own cooking throughout the book. Has spending all that time with your mother with these recipes, has they improved how you're doing with them?
Not a lick. Not a bit. Some people, you know, the key element in all this is the ghosts. It's the ghosts who cook at my mother's right hand. As we say in the introduction, you know, it's the ghosts. It's the stories that it comes from. It's what we have instead of a cookbook. And so I don't have, but the second element is patience. You know, is you got to have patience to cook most of this stuff. I never had any patience for anything. It's why I'm a bad cook and a bad card player and a bad fisherman. and I just don't have the patience to do it right. But that said, not just right can still be really good. You know, I can make pinto beans and ham, but I can't make a decent skillet of cornbread to save my life. I can make really good mashed potatoes, but, you know, the artistry of a creamed onion, you know, slowly cooked in a little bit of bacon grease and butter and water so that it doesn't fry, it just melts. That, I don't have it. And so what I do is I write a story about it.
The name of the book is The Best Cook in the House. Rick Bragg, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
This is my pleasure. I can't remember when I've run my mouth so much and enjoyed it, but thank you.
Rick Bragg speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mother's Table. It's published by Knopf. He'll be a guest of the Tulsa City County Library and Book Smart Tulsa next Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock at Central Library. The event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.